Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 163 for August 30th, 2012. Toyota's All American. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hey, Peter.
Jim.
Good to be back doing After Hours again.
Another wonderful Thursday.
Yeah, we'll have Randy Stevens on from Toyota later in the show. We've got the brand new Avalon here in the studio, which I think a lot of people will be interested to learn more about because I don't think they've shown this a whole lot. It's been at auto shows, but...
Yeah, but, you know, when we see them at auto shows, it's just they blur, you know.
And mm-hmm.
You need to see them out in the road. And then with this, like... live and in person, you know, you get a better look at it.
Yeah, I agree totally. Hey, you had something interesting that I wanted to get you talking about in your rant on your website, autoextremist.com. There, I got a shameless plug in for you.
Yes.
We you talk it. About the need for car companies to really have an emotional connection with their product before the public does. And one thing that you wrote that really stood out with me is how you've got to be able to have finance people who get it.
Yeah.
When you say, you know, we got to put another $5 into this material. We've got to really upgrade it and whatnot. And they're going to argue against
for an interior.
Argue against it. Right.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, we've all known some enthusiast financial people, you know, so I'm not going to say, oh, you know, the old bean counter thing, they're all bad. And even Bob Lutz knows some financial people that are good. But, you know, you like to see people involved in the auto companies that do have an emotional connection with their products. It's more than just believing in them. They have to really feel it and understand it and understand their images of these cars so that they can convey that to the consumer. Because if you're just phoning it in, I think the consumer can figure that out pretty easily. And, you know, the buzzword and all, you're hearing it all now from the car companies. We have to establish emotional connection with our consumers. Well, you don't do that with blantastic products. You have to have a point of view. You have to have, you know, we've all talked about the ultimate initial product differentiator is still design. Design is a very emotional thing. Like if you showed people... okay, let's talk about the same drivetrain. You show people the Chevy Bolt, and then you show them the Cadillac Converge, and you say, well, basically underneath, they're, you know, it's the same drivetrain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think they're naturally going to gravitate to the Converge. Not that there's anything wrong with the Bolt. I think the Bolt, they did a nice job at. But it's the same thing, you know, they say young people, well, they're not into cars, and they don't, you know, they're into their phones. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of that's true. But even so, when you're around young people and you're on the street and something rolls by, you will hear an audible gasp like, oh, that's cool, you know. So this emotional connection thing, that's all we're going to hear now from these manufacturers. Mm-hmm. But before the manufacturers can convey it to the consumer, they got it. They got to believe it.
They got to believe it.
I mean, you know.
But I think they need more than that, too, because...
Well, they need a lot more.
Well, I know, but here's what I'm getting at is the industry does a great job of financial cost accounting. They can tell you what every nut, bolt, and washer, every component, all the material, everything. They can write down to the penny what the cost is, but they can't tell you what the value is. And what we need is some sort of... financial reporting system that captures value. I don't know how you do that. Yeah. I'm just saying that when car companies go and everything's got to be to the budget, and that's important. I understand that. But as you just talked about. You can have a blandastic car. It can check every single box. It can meet all the fuel economy standards, emissions, safety, blah, blah, blah.
Roominess.
Yeah, but it's boring, and nobody buys it.
Yeah. Well, look at the Corvette interior for years, a favorite whipping boy of the enthusiast community. Yeah, I love the car, but boy, the interior sucks. And then the new one coming, you know, we all know from everyone we're hearing that it addresses that.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone had gone to GM Financial and sat in a meeting and say, look, if you give us an extra $200, we can fix the C6 interior for, you know, a good bit of its rest of its run.
Mm-hmm.
Never would have flown. But think about, you know, the profitability in that car. They could have easily put that cost in that interior and sort of turned around this feeling that, yeah, Corvette's cool, but, you know, it's misses here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So allegedly that's all fixed in the C7, so we'll see. But that's the kind of thing. You're exactly right. The accounting people can tell you, you know, if we source that lug nut from this supplier, we'll save 3 cents a lug nut. And if we multiply that, our lug nut budget this year, you know, that's pretty good. But, you know, that doesn't translate to a wheel design attached to a car that people want.
Right.
So,
but I think what somebody's got to come up with a way that measures the value of things, not just the cost, so that you can win these arguments of saying this is why we have to make this investment.
Well, that's hard to do. And that's why people like Bob Lutz had such a long career,
mm-hmm.
because he accumulated this cred where he could say, sadly, that isn't going to work. This is what we're going to do, you know. But, yeah, measuring value, the impact of spending an extra $5 on that interior, hard to do.
Hard to do. Right. Right now you do need the Lutzes who are at the level, who have got the gut feel to say, yeah, go do it.
Yeah.
But so anyway, there's whoever out there can invent a way of capturing value, you're going to be a billionaire.
Yeah. So what else are we talking about?
I've been driving the Cadillac XTS this week, which, speaking about interiors, it's
gorgeous.
Gorgeous. It's knockout good.
That's a handsome car.
And the car overall looks good. But I got to say, dynamically, it's not like there's anything wrong with it. It just, to me, isn't quite there. Not as a Cadillac.
You know, it just feels like a large front-wheel drive GM car and not a Cadillac. Is it?
Right. That's a great way to put it. Rides well, handles well, you know, reasonably quiet inside and everything, but it's a Cadillac. You know, it should be awesome.
Talk about that emotional connection. It should be.
And, you know, listen to how much I raved about the ATS, the new small car from them. So, you know, I don't know what it is. It's not like I'm disappointed. I'm just not as enthralled as I really thought I would be with the car.
Well, you know, I think there's some point where size of a car should shift to rear-wheel drive first and then all-wheel drive instead of front-wheel drive first and then all-wheel drive. I don't know where that line is, but obviously the two American luxury car companies, Cadillac and Lincoln, are dying for a big full-size rear-wheel drive chassis.
Completely
architecture,
right.
Whatever you want to call it.
That's right.
You know, right. But I think there's a line you cross where it's better if it started out as a big rear-wheel drive car for that size car.
Mm-hmm.
And then right up until that point, they can be front-wheel drive. Now, the new Impala, what's going to happen when we drive that? Is it going to feel like a...
It's going to feel like an XTS.
It's going to feel like a big GM front-wheel drive car.
Probably, right.
I don't know.
No, there's just not enough road isolation in the Cadillac. You know, it's what I call... when I get in a luxury car, I want to be muted from the outside world.
Now, I remind our viewers and listeners that John is the guy who likes the A8 over the A7.
That's exactly true.
And I tend to agree with him. I thought he was full of it for a while until I drove an A7, which I love.
Yeah, it's a good car.
Great car, but boy, the A8, man, It is.
It's a flagship sedan.
It is sweet.
For the brand.
Yes, exactly.
No question about it.
And, you know, maybe the XTS isn't it because we know they're showing probably at the Detroit show the sedan version of the CL. And that's tipping their hand in 3 years for the 2015, whatever they're going to call the ultimate.
Yeah, I don't think they should do that. I don't think they should tip their hand that early.
Well, I've been saying that for years.
I know.
I don't think they, you know, if it was my car company, I'd show up at the Detroit Auto Show completely by surprise with order books in hand. The car company who can do that, I think, is going to be a success. And, boy, if there's ever a car company that has the table set to do that, it's Ford with the Mustang, the new Mustang. They should lock that thing down. They shouldn't show it until they're ready to sell it. There should be, you should be able to order it right at the auto show.
In fact, you know what they should do, really, is go back to the old days and paper over the showroom windows and let people go to the dealerships to see it for the first time.
Yeah.
The dealers would like that.
Oh, sure they would like it. Boy, that would be a chore in the digital age.
I know. But think of the buzz you would create.
Well, the best thing they would do to not hold any media previews at all.
Right.
The media sees it when it arrives at the showroom.
Sarbanes-Oxley, baby. Everybody gets it at the same time.
That's what I would do. If I was CEO,
yeah.
That is what I would do, in case you're wondering if I took over General Motors.
Right. I thought it was when.
Yes.
Speaking of General Motors, man, I think there's a brain drain going on at the company.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on, but, you know, it's like maybe it's the last one out, you know, turn the lights off.
Well, you know, Chris Baroni-Bird just left the company, and our longtime viewers will know him. We've had him on the show before. He did the Autonomy, which was the skateboard with the fuel cell built into the chassis. He did the Envy, you know, came on the show to talk about that and all. Then earlier this year, Alan Taub, who was the vice president of research and development.
Who took over for Larry
Burns. For Larry Burns. Look, Larry retired well before retirement age. Alan Taub retired well before retirement age. Bob Purcell, who was so heavy into the EV1, I think he left 2 years ago or whatever. But I'm, and then earlier this year, they chopped a quarter of their R&D workforce, at least in the U.S., and I'm going, what is going on here?
Yeah, I don't know. Now, Chris is going to Qualcomm.
Right. Which, and I didn't know this before, Qualcomm, that Chris Baroni-Bird's going to, does electric vehicle recharging stuff. So I can't believe that doing chargers is anywhere as near interesting as doing autonomies and NVs and stuff like that. So...
Well, there is, it's not very difficult to discern that there is a giant morale problem at GM.
There's that, but I also wonder if, you know, GM Research used to be a pure research entity, not applied research where you say, oh, how do we make this ABS system work? No, I mean, they were doing, well, hell, GM R&D was heavily involved in the lunar rover that NASA put on the moon.
Right.
They were heavily involved in some of the original heart transplant, artificial heart stuff. I mean, that's what I mean by applied science. They were just going out and doing all kinds of wild and crazy things that had nothing to do with the auto industry. And they chopped all that out. And they said, no, we can't spend money like we used to, so now it's got to be just on the auto industry. And now I'm thinking, when I see the Larry Burns's, the Alan Taubs, the Chris Baroni-Birds of the world leave GM, that it's like, hey, we're not even going to do super advanced stuff anymore. We're just going to do things that apply to getting it in the plants and running down the line.
Well, that may be true. I mean, if we could get him to talk, get Chris back on the show.
Well, they'll never do that. What we need to do is get somebody like John Lochner, to whom R&D now reports and says, what's going on there?
Yeah, what up, John? Last time I talked to John, I was standing next to him at the New York Auto Show when they unveiled the Pontiac El Camino thing.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I turned to him, and he said, what do you think? I said, John, it will never see the light of day. What are you talking about? I mean, he was so hurt. I said, John, come on, man. That's the last time.
And you had it right.
That's the last time I talked to him. He's well thought of inside GM, so.
Well, you know, he's hopefully he's doing good things for him, but he's got a lot of people quitting left and right. So, like I say, we talked about just a few weeks ago, when you see that much turmoil going on, you know, something else is simmering below the surface.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure GM would have an answer for us that, you know, turmoil and, you know, changeover is just part of the business. But
well, in all the time I've covered this business and knowing the history of it that I do, I've never seen so many key technical people quit a car company in such a short amount of time that had nothing to do with retirement age.
Yeah, it's significant.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm hearing that morale is not great.
Oh yeah, no,
that's no news though. Yeah. That's been that way for a certain amount of tenure.
Right. Hey, why don't we take a break and we'll get Randy Stevens in here and we'll talk about what he's doing with Toyota in this new Avalon. So yeah, let's take a quick break. Randy, thanks for joining us on the show here.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I had no idea what kind of following you guys had until it got around within the company that I was going to be on the show. Just want to say hi to JP and Andy. They really watch the show all the time.
Cool. That's great.
How did you arrive at this position?
Well,
what's some of your background? So,
right out of college, right out of Michigan State, I had a job at a supplier and had a chance to kind of toil in the trenches, doing design work and manufacturing work. It was a great experience. Then, based on financial difficulties at that supplier, went to Mazda Motors in Flat Rock and got a little bit more of a manufacturing background, which was great. Unfortunately, they went through a little bit of a financial issue, and Ford came in and didn't really need the engineering staff. So I had a great opportunity to move back into design at Toyota and, you know, really got to start with one other guy, and we started the chassis department at TTC, so it was a great opportunity.
So your title is chief engineer?
Chief engineer, yeah. I'd spent about 10 years in the chassis design and then move over to vehicle development. Put a couple of years into the Camry development, 2002 Camry, mm-hmm. a great experience. And then, again, fortunate enough to an opportunity to open up for Avalon for the transfer of responsibility from Japan to the U.S., so got into that.
A little bit about that, because I find that fascinating that Toyota's now doing design, engineering, and manufacturing. This is the first pass car that's been done totally in the U.S. for Toyota, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, Toyota Technical Center, I think, started that kind of activity in about 2004 with the Solara. But it was still with a chief engineer that had come from Japan and then was local. And all the engineers were North American and all the planning. So it really was truly a North American product at that time. But it's still a little bit different with a Japanese chief engineer. Ultimately, they get to make the final decision. So then in 2009, myself, Greg Burness, and now Mike Swears are chief engineers. And it really gives us a chance to not only make our own decisions, but really listen to North America and join with TMS on the sales side and our production engineers and kind of get together and really get a good consensus and go forward on these ideas.
So when you say TTC, you're referring to the place outside Ann Arbor?
Yes, Toyota Technical Center.
Right. Right.
But there's two locations outside of Ann Arbor, right?
Yes, we have four or five locations. We're in Arizona, Ann Arbor, mm-hmm. the Saline mm-hmm. Area, and then Livonia and Los Angeles.
Wow.
Yeah, 1,100 strong. Spread quite a bit.
And the design work for this car was done in L.A. or?
These were done by stylist Kelty in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
In our Ann Arbor studio. And the lead stylist for the exterior, Million, was his sketch and his idea. And kind of the rest of the team then pushed it through.
And Kevin Hunter runs all that design group. And
yes.
I got to believe the orders came out. Okay, go for it, guys. Really make this spectacular. We're not going to do nice but sort of bland cars, right?
Well, and it was clear at the time that Avalon, really, this was the last chance. You know, sales were down, and I think
sales are down a lot.
A lot, and I think it had a really good chance of not existing anymore. So we really, the whole team felt like it was our last chance, and especially on the styling side, the sketch that we picked was this one. But all of them were very progressive and very, very exciting. So it was a fun time.
Mm-hmm. Explain this to me. You got the title chief engineer, but I've read Jeff Leiker's book on, you know, product development at Toyota, and he talks about the Shusas.
Yes.
The Shusa, which is like God in the company for a product line. So is that like another step above where you're at, or how does that work?
The Shusa role is mainly in Japan, and it's a slightly different. We have a different structure here. But in Japan right now, the way it's set up is the chief engineer is over typically several either products or a product in several destinations. And then the Shusa will be like absolutely living with the vehicle, like the Corolla of North America, whereas the chief engineer will have the Corolla all over the world. Mm-hmm. So that Shusa role is absolutely critical for vehicle development.
You've got to be concerned, maybe elated, that Chevy's got a new Impala coming and you guys are going to be battling it out face-to-face in the market.
Honestly, I can't wait. Within the last 2 years, I think we've had, what, 5 or 6 new entries? And it's the funnest, best time in the industry.
So what the others were, what, Maxima, Taurus?
Maxima hasn't renewed yet. I think that's
okay,
next year.
Yeah, right.
But the Taurus had a nice refresh. The LaCrosse with the e-assist, the Azera, Genesis, Chrysler 300. Mm-hmm. So it's
a hot segment.
The segment is fantastic, and that's great for us because the volume and the excitement is needed to kind of keep things going, and it gives us a chance to really compete and, you know, keep the engineers motivated.
So what's the drivetrain in this car?
We've got the 2GR 3.5 liter V6 and our 6-speed automatic transmission, tried and true, 268 horsepower, really strong motor.
And I got to believe there's a hybrid coming of this thing, too.
There is. We were fortunate enough to get the hybrid system that is being was developed for the Lexus ES and the Camry. That second generation of that hybrid system is fantastic. Smooth, powerful, very similar power to our V6s of about, you know, a generation ago. So there really isn't any kind of things to give back to get a hybrid anymore. Plus the 40 mile per gallon combined, we're able to achieve.
That's what you're going to get in this car?
In the hybrid version. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I tell you, with the full-size fuel tank, which a lot of our competitors don't offer, when you get into the hybrids, we've got a range of 680 miles, which is just phenomenal. We're really, really happy with it.
Size-wise, where does this car come out? And let's say in terms of the new Impala or the 300?
Yeah, from the 300 size, it's a smaller exterior significantly. Impala, I haven't checked, but I think it's also smaller. That looks like a pretty big car.
Yeah.
But on size power, probably with the Maxima, but more interior room.
I wonder if Nissan's even going to keep the Maxima going. I mean, they have dumped so much money behind the Altima, that's a little off topic, but you guys have to wonder, too. I mean, I don't know. They have dumped so much marketing money in that name. I'm not so sure that they could resurrect Maxima. And besides that, what would Maxima be?
Right.
I wouldn't be
surprised. What do you guys know about it?
We don't know really anything, but my thoughts would be I would think they would continue. It's got a great heritage, great name, and I think it would behoove them to keep that going.
Well, you know, originally their strategy, this goes back almost 2 decades ago, was to sort of do a pincer movement around the Camry and the Accord. They were going to have the big Maxima and the smaller Altima, but the Altima is, I think most people might confuse the new Altima for the Maxima. It looks not dissimilar from it, and the size has increased so much.
Yeah, and all the features and, you know, the interior quality. It's a really nice mm-hmm. car. So, yeah, they definitely have some work to do. But that's the role, I think, of all these cars, is to push other cars, not only within the segment, but within your own company.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the game of the industry, though. Whatever, who's ever out the latest has all the latest stuff until next week when somebody else comes out
right
with their thing.
But, you know, this car and the other cars in its class are what were typically or historically, the typical American size sedan. And when you talk things like 40 miles per gallon in a car this size, do you think that segment could grow, or is it just going to stay where it is?
I certainly think so. The excitement, not only of the fuel economy, but of the features and the dynamic performance of these cars have grown so dramatically that I think people can come back comfortably from SUVs if they need to, or they can move up from a standard midsize. And the prices actually are going down in the segment, so we're also trying to compete with the the midsize. So it's going to be very even more competitive in the next few years.
What would a base Avalon cost, more or less?
Well, we haven't released pricing
yet. I know, that's why I said more or less.
Okay, well, the current one is $33,000 it starts at. We're strongly pushing to pull to introduce two models below that when we launch.
Wow.
So that's really a response to the segment. It's pushing us to do that, and we need to for our customers for value.
Cool. I love hearing about that because all I ever see is car prices going up.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting front end for you guys. Well, the design looks pretty good, but front end is a departure, isn't it?
Yeah, the front end, again, a definite signature for the car. Our designers wanted to set up a kind of what we call a lower priority, where the center of gravity of the car just looks lower. So the features on the lower part of the car are really important. A lot of either cars within our own company or other cars kind of push things up to the upper grille or something like that, chrome up high. But we wanted to push things down. And then moving up to the headlamps, which are a completely new technology, going for a very slim headlamp, again, trying to keep the focus on the lower part, we're able to have a first-in-the-world technology for the headlamps.
What's that?
Dual square projector. So it's really cool. We worked with our supplier, I.I. Stanley, to develop this technology. It's a standard projector bulb behind it, mm-hmm. So it's no additional cost to service for the customer, but it gives you a very thin profile.
And they're square.
And they're square, to double square.
I've never seen a square projector, I don't think. Have I? Is this a? Is that the first
world's
part?
World's first. And then also, from our measurements, the thinnest LED daytime running lamp system. So overall, it's a nice front signature, but the key is it met the styling image that we were given to keep things slim and clean.
Hmm. And why don't we take a look inside, too?
Oh, great.
We'll have Chip take the camera there, and we've got Kurt McAllister. He's our Vanna White for the day show. Is going to be pointing out things for us.
Yeah, I'd like to go over a few key features.
Yeah, Appreciate it.
First thing that we learned when we did our customer research is that our customers wanted a good place for their cell phone or iPod. So we went through this design activity and came up with this style, which is the E-bin, electronics bin. And it's an area where you put your phone, a nice soft hand-wrapped place to put your phone where you can see it and it's comfortably in front of you. With Bluetooth now, really, we don't need a lot of cords and stuff to hook up, so it just sits there. But if you do need to, you can open the tray, and there's a spot for cords underneath that can pass through, or you can hide an iPod. There's charging where your USB, everything is comfortably put in there with a nice soft flocked interior so there's no scratching of
it. So just a nice way, then you push that little tray right out of the way with the phone in it, and you got
have your all access,
storage.
Or mm-hmm. You can push it back, and it still hides all that stuff underneath.
Very nice. Very simple, but very nice.
Yeah, and then we'll move up, and we've adopted capacitive switches for the HVAC and multimedia area.
What's that mean, capacitive switches?
Capacitive switches are a smooth, non-sort of button switch where you use the capacitance from your finger to activate the switch. We've added physical cues.
Ooh. Yeah, we're oohing and aahing here as we see this. Right?
We've added physical cues so you have a place to rest your finger and know where the switch is. Mm-hmm. So it's very clean and easy to understand. So again, that's our take on capacitive. We kept some mechanical switches like volume and tuning and defrost and some things that we think are most logical. And our customer research research showed that those are the things they wanted to keep, you know, kind of like a home audio system. You want to have a volume knob, want to have a tune.
I agree totally. When it's something that you go and use all the time, just make it a knob. It's so easy to
use. Just reach over.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
good call.
Thank you. And then moving up, we made a lot of effort to coordinate. We have 3 color screens in the car. And really, one of the things I don't think Toyota's done a great job with is coordinating our screens and our fonts and mm-hmm. colors. Mm-hmm. So we took a big effort to do that. And on the inside of the car, we have 3 color. That's the multimedia. And then below it is the HVAC screen, which, again, is color and unique. But matches, and then in the combination meter, there's the 3rd color screen where the driver information is shown.
So, how do I ask this question? I love how you've got that all integrated. Same fonts,
yes.
Whether you're looking at the IP on the console or different screens, what's it take to get those all the same? Because BMW, for example, is brilliant at nailing that.
Yes.
And I've always been astonished where you get into cars and you go, my God, it's like 3 different design teams worked on this interior.
Yeah. And I have to be honest, Toyota historically has been the same way. We've got different design engineers for different areas, and we try to, when it makes sense, use parts from other cars. And sometimes I don't think we execute that properly. So we wanted to step back, start over, and say, we're going to nail this.
Is it more costly doing it that way?
It really isn't. It's just you have to recognize it early enough in the process and then just do it. It's really no difference. You just have to think about it, basically.
Hmm. Like so many other things in this business, if you accommodate it early in the design, it really doesn't cost more to
do.
Right.
If somebody points it out at the end, it's very difficult and costly.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I'd like to point out is one of the big parts of this car and all Toyotas is getting back to a high-quality interior. So many of not only Toyota cars but our customer or our competitor vehicles, I think, have gotten away from the high-quality, good touch feel. So we've added 14 of these soft, wrapped, stitched panels to the car in those key areas where customers touch.
These are hand-wrapped?
These are hand-wrapped, stitched, and just a very high quality. And all the other materials are soft as well, but these particular points are extra soft and extra accommodating.
So how do you do that? How do you go with higher-grade materials? How do you do hand-wrapping, which is more expensive than having machines do it, and hold the lid on cost?
It comes down to priority. We absolutely had to do that. There's the styling, the dynamic performance, interior quality absolutely had to be done. And you work your project around those things.
And you look for cost offsets elsewhere then? Or
within our system, there's ways to do that. The chief engineer gets a certain amount of funds to execute certain things. And in the interior, we're also able to work with our product planning group, our sales group, and they contributed kind of part of their pie to it. And so it was a team effort, but when we came out, we said, we absolutely have to do this. We have to nail those areas.
Hmm. What's the weight of it?
The weight, we're at about 3,500 pounds.
That's pretty good.
We were able to reduce the mass of the vehicle by 110 pounds over the previous generation, which was another absolute critical portion for us because of the fuel economy targets and trying to be best fuel economy, which at this stage we are for V6 vehicles.
Hmm.
So again, working with our suppliers who are extremely helpful, our body engineers, again, everybody pitched in to really do a good job on lightweighting the car.
Well, that's going to be a huge thing from now on.
I keep saying the second half of this decade, from 2015 mm-hmm. to 2020, I say lightweighting is going to be the thing that will have pretty much run through the easier powertrain stuff to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I read what's going to be happening.
Well, the new Golf, 7th generation Golf, is allegedly 200 pounds lighter.
I know.
Wow. That's a lot out of
a little car, right?
Well, it's not so little anymore, but still, it's a lot.
Well, it's littler than this one.
Yeah.
That's why I said 3,500 pounds is not light, but for a car this size, that's extremely competitive.
Yeah, we're, from our measurements, best in class in mass efficiency. And until this stage, the Nissan Maxima, which is a very light car, had that title. But the way we measure it, we're now the most mass efficient. Of course, everybody's going to be shooting for that and achieving more, and we'll have to achieve more. But
mass efficient, what? Is that the footprint versus curb weight?
Exactly.
Are those 18-inch wheels and tires?
Those are 18-inch. We went up to 18-inch on this vehicle and the high-performance V-rated tires.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So when does it arrive at the showroom?
It looks like it'll be mid-November of this year. We start production in October, so it takes a little bit to fill the pipeline.
Go back to the lightweighting.
Sure.
Are you guys doing all this high-strength steel? Like, you got to be doing what everybody else. Or did you go aluminum intensive? Or what did you do to get the weight down?
Right. No, for us, we're still a steel-based mainly company. That's where our expertise is, and especially on the manufacturing side. So steel is really our focus for this, I would say, generation of lightweighting. As we go on, we probably will have to. But significant use of high and ultra-high strength steel in the body structure. We were also really fortunate. One of our suppliers, JCI, for the seats, had a really lightweight steel seat frame that was being developed, so we were able to use them. And then, again, working with all of our suppliers, if you give them a target and a reason for it, it's amazing what kind of ideas they come back with. Our wheel suppliers, even the tires are lighter. Everything just pitches in. If you think about 110 pounds is a lot, but it really only works out to be, you know, 1 or 2%. So if everybody pitches in, you can achieve those. Now, it's the next generation, I think, that's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, definitely. What about this new crash standard from the IIHS, the Insurance Institute, this what they call the small offset. Did you guys design for that?
We did not. We're in stages for the very near future of working on that. A very challenging crash standard and a little bit of a surprise timing-wise. It was in the kind of rumor mill and it was being discussed. But it's a little bit different than NHTSA or the government. We get a lot of time, and there's a lot of back and forth between the automakers and NHTSA. But, you know, IHS develops something quickly and then releases it, and now everybody's reacting to it.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, that almost sounds unfair because it puts the industry in an embarrassing situation. When you don't know what you're going to get tested for, bang, you get hit for a test, and it was like, God, if you'd let me know, I could have gotten ready for this.
Well, we're working on it as fast as possible, so we'll make the
new. So you can retrofit things onto this car?
Absolutely, yeah.
But that's just going to add weight, right?
It is, and it is, and we'll have to find other ways to reduce weight. Absolutely correct.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Doors optional.
Yeah. That's right. So, you know, this would probably be a good time to take another break. Are we missing anything else on the car that we were going to take a look
at? I wanted to go over the exterior of the car a little bit.
Let's do that first.
Great. We'll start from the back of the car. The very first sketch we saw from the car about 2.5 years ago was this great little three-quarter sketch of the rear three-quarter. And it was done by one of our stylists, Milian, from Calty.
In fact, we got the drawing up on the screen.
And there's
now
his exact sketch. And it just mesmerized the team. We were energized, excited. There's a ton of momentum within the company. When we saw, we're like, we've got to make this. This is gonna be the future of Avalon. And so it starts at the rear three-quarter, but as you head down the side of the vehicle, there's a great character line.
Yeah, very pronounced.
That we had to keep. And from a stamping standpoint, it's very difficult because it's a reverse curvature as it comes down through that line. And our manufacturing team, production engineering and manufacturing, did a phenomenal job to keep that.
And we should point out the difficulty is not in doing that door or that door or that fender or that fender, but making sure they all blend
together. They all have their own challenges, and then making them line up is
because it changes from panel to panel, and yet that scalloped look has got to match up.
And the door scallops with around the handles, again, another challenge just to keep all that together. Also, on the side of the vehicle, one of the things that we felt really passionate about was keeping some motion and emotion to the side of the car. A lot of times you'll see the side of a car is kind of flat, but they have a really crazy front bumper. And we didn't want that. We wanted it to flow seamlessly through from front to rear. So as you go down the side of the car, you'll see there's three distinct character lines. We tried to keep something low, something that gave it some low character. Again, that lower priority that we were looking for.
And some of these lines are very subtle. A number of them I didn't even notice until I, you know, went walking around the car and touching the sheet metal. It's like, ooh, that's very subtle.
And challenging from a stamping standpoint, because the steel has a chance, you know, a tendency to kind of rebound and all that stuff will get washed out. But again, the stamping has done a phenomenal job to keep all those intact.
Mm-hmm. What else?
The overall height of the car has been lowered by 25 millimeters, about an inch. And again, the goal is to give a sleek, long look to the cabin. We've added the quarter window back in that was in a previous generation, again, to give that long look.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing what's going on in the design business, how trends, I mean, you can see, I mean, there are a lot of cars that are looking like this, mm-hmm. sort of from 50 yards away.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the front of the car, the hood has two really nice character lines that again, I think Toyota really needs to be more expressive, and this is our interpretation of that.
You've stated, your Uber leader has stated, we're going to build more exciting cars.
Yeah.
Akio.
Yeah. And I think in our case, the driving performance matches that, and I'm really excited for you guys to have a chance to drive.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, because driving performance wasn't really part of the Avalon equation.
Yeah.
So you said you went after that a little bit in this...
Exactly, yeah. One of the early research activities we did was with a small group of media, Michael Jordan, Dennis Simonitis, and John Stewart. We got them out to drive our car and our competitors, and it was a fantastic activity. But at the end of it, they pretty much sat us down and said, look, you guys have got to make your cars more fun to drive. And
define that. What do you mean by more fun to drive? Because this is an Avalon.
Right, right. Fun to drive to me, and what I picked up from them is it's a car that you can enjoy in several different situations, and when you get out of it, you want to get back in. You want to have more experience trying different roads, different things. It's a fun thing to do.
Because with the current generation car, a lot of us have said, this is the best Buick that's ever been made. You know, very soft, very plush, but you've tautened this up some.
Absolutely. And we talked about lightweighting, but we transferred that into torsional rigidity. We dramatically improved the torsional rigidity of the body, which helps with not only handling, but ride comfort, stability, all of the things that are just critical nowadays. And again, the suspension engineers did a phenomenal job tuning the car. We did a lot of off-site tuning. Typically in the past, we tuned on-site at our proving grounds and did a lot of that. But I think what you end up with is a lot of the cars that feel the same because you're going over the same surfaces. So our tuning engineers said, hey, we've got to get out of our areas. And we went to roads all over the country, took all of our competitors as well as our car, tuned them, retuned them, tried different things, and I think came up with a really nice package.
Hmm. Well, this is cool. This is very interesting.
Great.
I'm really interested in the dynamic difference. We'll just have to try it out.
Yeah.
Can't wait for your opinion.
Okay, now let's take a break, and then let's get into rapid fire, because we got a bunch of questions for you here, Randy.
The scary part of the show.
Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Okay, this is the rapid fire part of the show where we get into the audience questions. Ben, let it rip. Okay, Mike DeWight wants to know, what's the release date for the Avalon? And I think what he means is, when's it going to be in showrooms?
Yeah, it looks like mid-November, approximately the 15th.
Okay, so not too far away.
No, not too much.
Jeremy L. Jones says, when's Toyota going to come to market with direct injection and other new technologies?
We do have direct injection on some of the Lexus motors, and it's definitely in... the works for all vehicles, just depends on the timing and, you know, the best time for a particular model.
I assume you're going to add multiple gear transmissions beyond six speeds?
That's definitely in the works. The exact timing is not known.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on CVTs? You know, Nissan's really making a lot of hay with that now.
Right, and I haven't had a chance to drive the Altima, but I've read great things. And I think we've done great things in the CVTs for our hybrids, but not so much yet in the internal combustion engine. So I think it remains to be seen.
No rush.
We haven't been fans of CVTs, though I got to admit, Nissan's done a pretty good job. And it seems to me it's higher torque engines seem to do okay with CVTs. Low torque engines, the thing's always whizzing around and rubber banding and all that. Oh, GoPrius wants to know, have you ever driven an LFA?
LFA? No, I have not, but I've seen them, and I would love to.
Me too.
I would love to.
You haven't driven one, have you, Peter?
No, but that video is cool with the Formula One driver. I forget his name. Ringing it out. Have you seen that video?
No, I haven't.
Oh, man.
Huh.
Boy, that thing sounds good.
Avalon used to have a bench seat, then ditched it. Is it coming back?
It's probably not coming back in the near future. The first and second generations had them. The usage was so incredibly low. The sales just continued to slide. And it seemed like something that just was something that was not being requested anymore.
But, you know, dealers order cars.
Yeah.
Were customers even seeing the bench seats? I'm not sure I ever saw a bench seat Avalon. I'm not sure. Maybe in a picture. But...
I saw one in a rental car. It was a long time ago.
We had one in our fleet. And, you know, I guess to be fair, it was barely usable. I mean, the actual seat is like this big and the seat belt, and it's just really, really a challenge from a packaging standpoint.
So, yeah, go Prius. Sorry, no bench. Hey, we've got a phoner here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Hi, it's Jonathan out in Old Japan. Quick question about the Tesla S. 0 to 60 in 3.9. Lateral G handling of 0.92, 0 to 60, 60 to 0 stopping in 105 feet in the latest test. Stunning good looks. I think it has 5 or 7 passenger capacity. What's your opinion of this thing? Is it going to be a winner, or is it a flash in the pan? I'm digging it. I really
what
am.
What are we talking about?
Thank you very much. I look forward to tonight's show.
Yeah. Thanks, Jonathan. He's asking about the Tesla Model S. Yeah. And, yeah, I'll bet it's a pretty good car. But as I've said all along, I think the Volt is a pretty good car. I think the Leaf is a pretty good car. And they don't sell very well. And I'm afraid that the Tesla S will sell much better than the Roadster. But I don't think that's saying much. The question is, how many vehicles does Tesla have to sell to completely recoup the investment it made in that? And my fear for them is they're not going to sell enough to pay off their investment.
No, they're not. And they're going to have to live off the government subsidies.
Right. Okay, Mitch W. wants to know, Randy, what new skill sets are in demand at Toyota Engineering?
Toyota, I would say, is still a very hands-on company. When we
you do a lot in-house.
We do. When we interview engineers, which are really tough to find right now, by the way.
Everybody's complaining about that.
We honestly look for experience, simple experience, you know, whether they work on their own cars or whether they have experience at companies where they're, you know, putting things together, taking things apart, just really fundamental skills. So the more of those that you can get, the better. The computer stuff is just a given nowadays. You're going to have CAD, you're going to have CAE, you're going to have CFD, you're going to have all that stuff. But it's really the fundamentals that we look for.
Very interesting. So grade point average in school is not as important if you've got the hands-on experience?
For Toyota, it's not.
Wow. Because remember when we had Lutz on, that was one of his complaints, is that GM would not hire anybody with, what, under a 3.5 GPA? And he was saying, Jesus, we got all these guys who are great with their hands, but you won't hire them.
Yeah,
and,
well, that's probably why they wouldn't hire me then.
What about carbon fiber components, getting into more of your mass production cars? Where do you see that going?
I see it as a possibility. We have used, like, recycled carbon fiber in parts, stuff like that. It's a volatile market, though. We found that when we were using the recycled carbon fiber, the market swings dramatically. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, the supply actually completely dried up. We had to get out of it.
Because what I heard is a lot of the recycled stuff was engineered scrap, if you will, from the aerospace companies. Mm-hmm. And as they've gotten better and better and better at reducing their engineered scrap, yeah. There's nothing left over to recycle.
Well, that happened in about 2007 because the supply dried up and we had to get out of that. As far as, you know, formal carbon fiber, I don't have any experience with that. I have some plastic molding experience, you know, injection molding, but I don't know.
Did you allow an exhaust note to creep into the Avalon?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. It's nice. It's pretty nice. I think you'll like it.
Cool.
And balance that with induction noise and all that, too?
Yeah. The straight-up engine noise, again, we're trying to eliminate as much as possible, but when you get to that certain RPM, you will hear a nice note.
Well, you know, noise is not just noise, because I've always said that BMW engines are not necessarily quiet. Porsche engines are not quiet, but God, do they sound good. So not all noise is created equal.
That's right. If you step on it, I think you'll be rewarded.
Dr. Botox says, I've been impressed with the Avalon for the past 6 years due to its content. Xenon lights, adaptive cruise control, and most importantly, air-conditioned seats, yeah. All for about $35,000. Yeah. Why buy the Lexus ES350, he asks.
The Lexus it's not my side of the business, but the Lexus buyer is a different buyer looking for a different experience.
It's a different emotional connection, John.
I'm never going to bring up that topic with you again.
Yes, no, we're going to talk about it. I want to talk about it some more.
Wright Knight says, why not make the next Avalon a rear drive Toyota flagship?
It's something I would love to consider and love to do. We don't have that manufacturing capability currently in the U.S., which is where we need this to be
made. You build it in the truck plant.
Yeah, we definitely would love to do it. We'll look into that.
Okay. You heard it here first, Wright Knight. Let's see. Well, this is off topic a little bit. David says, hey, I'm a big Mustang head. I heard the next version will use a revised version of the current chassis. What do you guys know?
That's not true.
You heard it here first.
It's going to be new.
All new chassis. All new architecture. What do you guys use? Platform architecture, chassis, what?
Platform.
Platform. Okay. Hey, we got another phone call here. Ben's warning me it's a little hard to hear. Let's see if we can get that in here.
Wow, it's really hard to hear. Well, let's move on.
Yeah. It's not going to worry. Okay. Let's see. Catalan Alexei says, about Alfa Romeo, the main problem of Alfa is it doesn't have a real model range. The B-Class Mito and the C-Class Giulietta can't make the money that Alfa needs. Mr. Marchionne plans to make Chrysler as profitable as he can and use the money he needs for Alfa. Let's see if I can count this down. Can you get Mr. Marchionne on the show? we're trying, Catalan. We're trying.
Oh, yeah, we'll put another call to Gualberto right now.
Yeah. So Jeff says, I was thinking about Peter's rants from the last few weeks, and I have to say, I must agree with Lieutenant Dan on some levels. Although GM has its best product lineup ever, the heart of their product line seems to be mid-pack or worse in many of the reviews I read. I'm paraphrasing now. The mediocre Cruze has falling market share. The Malibu has endured a stillbirth launch. I tend to think Dan's treatment of his employees is a symptom rather than a cause. The product people are not getting the right cars right at fundamental levels. What do you think?
I think the Cruze is an outstanding car.
I do.
I really do. I think the problem comes in where Ackerson doesn't have the right kind of experience to be saying the things he does. I think he hears that from other people in the company, but I don't think he has a grasp of what it really means. And that's what I was trying to say in the last two comms from 3 and 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I think there's a tone deafness going on. There's certainly a leadership style problem, and some of the criticisms I see on some of the GM cars, I just flat out don't agree with. Saying the Cruze is a mediocre car It's not. It's a very good car.
Well, then you're going to like this next one. This is from J.D. Clough. He says, in my opinion, Dan Ackerson must be suffering from Alzheimer's. He's totally screwing GM up. Rick Wagner was doing a better job. Now, there's an insult.
Well, I will say this for Rick. For a financial guy, he knew when to raise the white flag and say, I got to bring Lutz in because I...
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, I won't criticize Rick for that because that was the right move. That was as significant a move as Bill Ford saying, you know what, I got to bring someone in, bring in Alan Mulally. And for Rick Wagner to do that as a CEO, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's saying, you know, I can't do this. I don't know enough about to get where we need to go. I'm going to go call Bob and see if he'll help.
Yeah, no, it was a gutsy move. A.M. Guerrero wants to know, Randy, is the Avalon still a North American-specific model? Any plans to offer it in Asia? Other manufacturers like Hyundai and Chrysler are taking their large cars to new markets around the world.
The Avalon is currently sold also in the Middle East, and this one will go there as well. Very popular and I think a very well-performing car. We're also planning to sell it in South Korea for the first time.
Oh, interesting.
So we've got a few months to work that production out, but then with the free trade agreement, that's made that very simple.
The free trade agreement with the United States. How interesting.
Yeah.
Because it'd be very difficult for the Japanese to get into Korea.
Correct. Correct.
Pretty cool. Mike D. White says, so now that Avalon's done, what are you doing?
Well, it's not done. We've got a couple months left to tweak the production, get the quality we need for the launch, and then we work a little bit more on the South Korea launch, and then we'll be done. So it never ends for us. The chief engineer continues with the project all the way through to production and to the next model, so
it'll
we just keep going.
It'll be interesting to see what kind of marketing campaign they do for this car, because before it was kind of asleep at the wheel, brought to you by Toyota, and now
right.
It's just like, wait a minute, no. You're going to like driving this, looking at it, how it feels, sitting in it. That's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and now we know you're the engineer, but what kind of marketing muscle are you going to put behind the car?
Well, it's been great. The marketing folks at TMS and Torrance have been very open to our kind of targets and what we wanted the car to be. So they want to continue that on into the marketing campaign. So it's under development now, but it's been a great team effort, and I'm really excited to see what they come up with.
Brian says, I know it's a fickle market, but any thought on coupes in Toyota's future, i.e. Solara, Camry, da-da-da-da?
Well, we don't have any formal plans, but there's a lot of young, energetic engineers at Toyota Technical Center, and I've seen sketch ideas for convertibles, for coupes, everything you could think of.
For the Sprint Cup edition?
If it takes off, you never know.
And Pierre Cardin AMX says, will the new Supra be Avalon-based?
Not to my knowledge.
It better not be. So,
Ben boosted that call.
Yeah, let's try that phone call that we weren't able to get in earlier.
Hey, John, Rick from San Diego. I was wondering if Toyota was expecting to lower the average buyer age and increase the sales of the Avalon, the new Avalon, in a similar fashion that they did with the current Toyota Camry SE, where the buyer age is now around, I believe, 45, which is on the lower in the age in the segment, and by adding the alloy wheels and the fog lights at the $23,500 price point, I believe it is, that makes it competitive with the Sonata and other competitors. Wonder if Toyota was expect the same with the new Avalon, with the new styling, and thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, no, very good question. And one of our targets is not necessarily to lower the age, but to broaden the appeal, to make the car more, perform better and look better. And we found as we talk to our current buyer, which is an older buyer, they're wanting us to do that. They want to see more technology. They're using iPhones, iPads. They're not worried about it. So we're not specifically targeting a certain age buyer, but we're trying to broaden the appeal, which would naturally, if it was successful, move the age down. And Camry was the same way. They didn't target necessarily a 45-year-old, but they put out a really nice Camry SE, and it's been very well received.
Hmm. Well, it's going to be exciting to see this in the marketplace, especially, you know, as you pointed out earlier, that this segment has just got a lot of new product in it.
Yeah, it is, and it's exciting. It's for a car guy, I love when we tear down our competitor vehicles just to see what kind of new ideas they've come up with, and there's just too many to list right now. We've got a long way to go to get ready for that next generation.
Well, we burned up an hour.
Yeah, we have. Thank you.
Great show. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for bringing the car in the studio.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. We really appreciate it.
Say hi to all the hardworking True Believers over there that you work with, because I know they're just as much True Believers as all the other companies in town here.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And Peter, great having you here, man.
Glad to be here.
Always fun to do.
I feel emotionally connected to the show.
Good. That's the way it's supposed to be. And we should let everybody know, too, most of you have seen the Bob Lutz show that we did a few weeks back. The television version of that is running this Sunday, or I should say this weekend.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. And so it's, you know, it's edited down because the TV version is so much shorter than this show. But it's kind of the best. So it's I'm just letting people know it could be something good to watch. And thank you all for having joined us tonight.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.